What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to Star Wars Beneath Twin Suns, a massive breakdown podcast. This is episode 89, coming to you after an extended break. We kind of wrapped up with Ahsoka, and then both Kutch and I had alternating weeks of just being out of town and also being sick. It was kind of a lot over the last few weeks, and we have really not been able to come back and bring you guys a podcast. Plus, it kind of felt like, let's be honest, a natural point in time to take a break since we had just finished up Ahsoka. But we are back. We are going to be doing something that we have talked about doing for a very long time. We're going to be going back and revisiting the Clone Wars animated series and doing it arc by arc as opposed to season by season, which when we did it season by season, we didn't really get to dive deep into stuff. So now we're really going to be hammering down on it. But first, let's go ahead and get the introductions out of the way. As always, I'm your host, Mercules, joined today by Kit Kutcher. And how are you doing tonight, Kit?
Hey, I am doing pretty fantastic, man. I am kind of excited to be talking about Star Wars again. It is the first time in a hot minute that we've been able to find some time to get together and do this. And, you know, it's also a bit of fun here because I've actually never watched this film before. And so this is like my first, sort of the first time I've actually sat down to watch it. And so it's really interesting because I feel like my impression of it now is probably really different from what it might have been if I had seen it when it came out.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think that a lot of people, and the IMDb score reflects this, I think that a lot of people who were not kids were extremely disappointed that this was even called a Star Wars movie when it released. So tonight we're just going to be going over kind of the first half of the movie because it is super late and we are still both kind of recovering from travel and just general related illnesses. So without expending too much energy, we're going to hit the first half of the movie and then we'll be back on Sunday with the conclusion of the movie. This is an interesting thing. It was designed to kind of serve as a bridge between the prequels and the new show that was going to be on Cartoon Network, which obviously we now know as the Clone Wars. And this movie was not something that was intended to ever exist. The only reason it even came about is because George Lucas was watching, he was reviewing footage from the first season and he thought, well, darn, this is pretty good. We should just make it a movie. And so they did. They combined a 3-episode arc, which was called the Castle Arc, actually, and a standalone episode. Chronologically, these are actually not the first episodes in the Clone Wars. We've talked before about the Clone Wars. You know what? I just thought of this. Maybe we should do the Clone Wars chronologically instead of by season.
I like
the arcs. Yeah. That might actually be pretty, pretty fun to do. So, anyways, chronologically, this is actually the third story. There are two standalone episodes before this, Cat and Mouse and Hidden Enemy. And then this is the third one that follows those, somewhat interestingly. I did try to watch this movie first. When I started the Clone Wars back in the COVID days, I tried to watch this movie first. And I will be honest, I did not get all the way through it. I gave up partway through. I kind of zoned out for a little bit, zoned back in, gave up, and just jumped straight into the TV show instead because I had heard preemptively that the TV show was much better than the movie. And so I figured, the movie doesn't really have any effect on it, so I'll just start with the TV show. And then when I was done with the TV show, I went back and I watched the movie and I was like, yeah, that wasn't as good as the TV show. And I didn't think about it again until literally you and I were talking about what we could do a breakdown of. And I was like, well, shit, I don't think we've ever done the Clone Wars movie. So here we are.
Yeah, I didn't even know it existed at first. And then I thought it was some sort of a spinoff from the TV show. And then I forgot about it again. And then I heard that it wasn't great. And then I forgot about it again. And somehow here we are years into watching the animated series and I had never actually gotten around to seeing it. So I have to say I'm kind of glad that I waited because I feel like at this point, I've accumulated so much like sort of behind the scenes knowledge and like appreciation for so many of the people who have, you know, worked on creating these shows, that my ability to forgive like weird quirks is actually like grown a lot. I feel like I'm a lot more tolerant of strange things in Star Wars than maybe I used to be. And so far, like, I mean, we can just get into it like from start to finish here. Unfortunately, I don't think there is like a true scene by scene synopsis of this. I'm half tempted to make one, but boy, that's also a lot of work. So we'll see if that happens. But
I think that it's also not really worth it because, like, yeah. To be honest, this
nobody else wants it.
what this movie is it is like a middling arc from the Clone Wars TV series that got a theatrical release. And that's what's so interesting to me, is that they picked an arc that, like, I don't feel like it was even the best arc in the first season. It just happened to be an early one. And to me, I feel like that was where the mistake was made. The only part that actually mattered was the standalone episode that became the introduction of the series, which was, I believe the episode was called, sorry, I'm trying to look this up. Basically, it's the introduction of Ahsoka, right? That was the only one that like actually really mattered. And the rest of them, it's kind of like, it was called The New Padawan. So it was four episodes. It was The New Padawan, which is a standalone episode. That would have been production number 118. That one actually mattered, right? But hilariously, the other ones, Castle of Deception, Castle of Doom, and Castle of Salvation, were the three that were like the Hutt storyline. That's a three-part arc. I didn't even feel like that was a good arc, right? Like, we got to think, season one has what? Malevolence, right? It has the Malevolence arc. Isn't the Malevolence arc like way better than this one?
I mean, probably, yeah. This one sort of is a, I feel like it's kind of a confusing arc. Like, I feel like this story arc would have been a little more difficult to do episodically, or would have ended up being multiple separate arcs that were just sort of loosely linked. Like, it feels a bit strange the way it's set up.
Bro, I mean, look at this. Okay, so to be fair, I'm looking at the season one episodes right now, and there's not a ton of like three-part arcs. There's a couple of two-part arcs, but there are two three-part arcs outside of this one that they used for the movie. So they use the castle arc, which is the Jabba the Hutt's son gets kidnapped. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Here are the other three-part arcs that are in season one. Malevolence, right? Which is Rising Malevolence, Shadow of Malevolence, and Destroy Malevolence. Malevolence, of course, being the ship that Grievous is captaining that has the giant ion cannon in it that disables other ships, and then they go out and they wipe out all the survivors so no one knows what happens. Really great arc. Even better, they have the Ryloth arc. Storm over Ryloth, Innocence of Ryloth, and Liberty on Ryloth, which is a fantastic arc, right? I feel like either one of those two. So they basically had three arcs that they could have chosen from to fold together to make a movie. The Ryloth arc may have been too late in production to have made that, because that was production numbers 119 through 121. But Rising Malevolence was 102 through 104, right? So like they're super early on in the season.
Yeah.
So part of me is like, man, you kind of just, you had a 50-50 shot and you just pulled the wrong one, right? Like the Malevolence arc is way better than the Castle one. And I think why I had checked out of this movie so many times is because like the introduction of Ahsoka was fun and appreciated and I liked it. But then, and like that whole episode where they're, you know, they're at the battle and everything like that, and Anakin's kind of like coming to terms with having a Padawan unwillingly. That part was good. That was only the first quarter, though. Then we had three more episodes, which were almost totally unrelated, which the best part about these episodes, honestly, was that Christopher Lee came back and provided the voice for Dooku.
Right.
We get, you know, the Clone Wars introduction of Asajj Ventress. And Samuel L. Jackson came back and provided the voice for Mace Windu. Right. Like that's pretty much legitimately the best part of the arc. The almost all of the rest of it is relatively forgettable and not really that great. And I think that's why it got hammered so hard in terms of critical reception and fan reception when it released. It didn't feel like a movie, is I guess what I'm trying to say. Like it didn't feel spectacular. It didn't feel bombastic. Like it didn't feel like something that deserved a theatrical release.
I think that's fair to some extent. I will say that I really enjoyed the opening battle scene. And as far as like the animated battles go, and maybe, you know, it has, I will admit, been a while since I've sat down and watched back through the Clone Wars, but I thought it was pretty great. Like the actual battle on Christophsis, when we're first opening up there with Obi-Wan and Anakin and Rex and Cody, like it felt big and impressive, and like there was a lot going on. There were a lot, they had a lot of bodies on the screen. Like there was a lot of moving parts. Like it felt pretty great to watch for me.
Yeah.
But it was a small piece. It was a small piece as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first 20 minutes, basically, and that's it. And I also really enjoyed the battle on Christophsis. I like the setting. This is interesting. So we talked about this, I think, before the show started, but George Lucas had a vision for Clone Wars. And you have to remember, at the time, there wasn't a ton of CGI like movies and TV shows on. The comparisons that were being drawn at the time when this released as a movie were to Beowulf, which tried to do like the hyper realistic CGI type thing and ended up like really deep in the uncanny valley, and Pixar, which had been doing like cartoonish, round, bright, cheerful style animation. And George very specifically wanted neither of those two things. His edict for how this show would be shot was he wanted it to feel like it was a live action movie that just happened to be animated in a stylistic way. And so because of that, he required them to use camera angles and stuff. Despite the fact that it's animation, the camera can literally be anywhere. He required them to use camera angles that you could do with actual cameras, so that it would feel like a Star Wars movie that just happened to be animated, right? And I really got that vibe when I was watching this, like so much so that it surprised me almost, because I have been watching so many other things in between, you know, since the last time I watched Clone Wars, right? And Rebels didn't really, you know, Rebels didn't really have to abide by the same rule. Bad Batch didn't really have to abide by the same rule. Even Clone Wars towards the tail end and the final seasons really kind of like moved away from that, oh, it has to feel like it's live action, right? They really only did that for the first like handful of seasons. But man, I was like slapped in the face with it when I was watching this. It really did feel like I was watching a movie from like every single shot that they had. And even the way they were treating the various characters in this, like how much time did we get during the Battle of Christophsis focused on like random clones?
Yeah,
that were either dying or fighting. Like there's the clone that runs up and punches a droid in the face and then gets shot. Like he punches a droid in the face, he's like, ah, my hand, and then it shoots him.
He gets half a Wilhelm scream before he dies.
Yeah, it was really, really wild. It was very, it's different even than the rest of Clone Wars, the animated series, in terms of how well they shot it. And I felt like when they decided to make it a movie, they like went back and they were like, all right, let's be a little bit extra in this. You know, let's give it some additional pizzazz. Let's treat it a little bit more seriously than we would have otherwise. And, you know, even the introduction where there's like all the clone chatter in the background and stuff, like I got like a little like Band of Brothers type vibe going on during the Christophsis battle.
Yeah. So there were definitely some weird shots in these first scenes. One that comes to mind, I can't help but laugh a little bit every time I think of it. After Ahsoka has arrived, they're trying to call back to the Jedi Council, and they're like routing the call through the cruiser that's in orbit that's just dropped Ahsoka off. And so they call the cruiser or whatever, and the cruiser's like, okay, we'll try to connect you to the Jedi Council. And then there's just like a weird pause where we sort of look at each of the characters, and they kind of each look at each other and kind of have just these like uncomfortable animated looks on their faces. And then we connect. It's just like, I feel like we probably could have cut about 2-3 seconds out there and nothing would have been lost.
Yeah, it's the entire episode reminded me of like an early 2000s video game, which is kind of accurate because the tools that they used for editing were Autodesk and Maya 3D, which are things that we use at Bungie for stuff. Obviously, this was a long time ago, and part of it was, you know, intentionally chosen, right? Like the stylistic design was supposed to pay homage to, you know, Japanese anime and manga a little bit, and like the British 1960s TV series Thunderbirds, which is actually not something that I'm familiar with. But as we know, Dave Filoni and George Lucas both love referencing things from their past. But like the way the characters move, the way the characters look, the way the backgrounds look, even the way like the vehicles and stuff looks, it all just reminded me of like a video game, from the 2000s. Like it is just a very particular graphical style. And I, to be honest, I didn't hate it. Like now I've got this weird sense of nostalgia for that time anyways, probably because I'm, you know, approaching my mid 30s. And I'm longing for the carefree, stress-free times of my youth. And seeing graphics like this like brings me back to that period of time. So it was like a weirdly calming sensation for me when I was watching it. Whereas normally I'd be like, man, wow, these graphics suck. But instead I was like, oh, they were simpler times back then.
Yeah. I think that's part of what I mean about like my ability to sort of forgive these oddities. Is I am kind of looking back through some rose tinted glasses in a way, and like, ah, yes, the good old days when animated series were very, very clearly animated series. I don't know why I'd be nostalgic for that, but there is something charming about these early attempts.
Do you remember there was a TV series that was, I think it might have been the very first CGI TV series? It was called like Reboot or something. Do you remember that? It was like the characters were the computer, like when a human being played a video game and played against computers, they were the computers that you like played against. But like when the human signed out, they like had a full life and they like went to a diner and like went to school and shit like that. You've never seen this series? It's literally called Reboot. You should look it up. It was from like 1994, right? So it was pretty old. And the CGI was like, obviously now looking back on it, the CGI was horrendous, right? But at the time, it was like the most mind-blowing thing I'd ever seen because I'd never even seen CGI before, right? Outside of like Pixar movies. So it was kind of interesting. And like I think the main point of the series was that like if the player won, it like actually killed the computer, like whoever the computer player was that was like playing against it. And so they had to like fight against the player, like literally for their lives. It was kind of dark for a kid's show, but it was actually pretty good. But watching this immediately like pulled me back to that. And I was like, oh, man, I just got like a powerful wave of nostalgia that I feel like deadened my critical sensors, which would normally have been going off and being like, hey, this isn't really that great. And instead I was like, oh, how delightful. Everything's got like a sepia tone over it. This is so wonderful. And that lasted for like legitimately like the first 20 minutes, pretty much the entire Christophsis battle.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think there's a little bit of that to it. And we, in all fairness, there are some entertaining scenes to be had here, especially in these first 20 minutes. And it really feels like things are starting off on a strong suit. We've got an irritated Anakin with a new Padawan. We've got Obi-Wan essentially pretending like this wasn't his plan all along. You know, we've got literally the worst best plan to sneak behind enemy lines. Obi-Wan negotiating to stall for time, you know, and some great clone versus droid battles. Like, I felt like there was a lot to like here, especially, and actually, I think I've just put my finger on it. Part of the reason I'm like enjoying this more, given all the screen time the clones are getting, is because of how like attached I became to the clones during the animated series. Like, I became so like emotionally involved in the tragedy of the clones' story arc that now I'm like, we're back at the beginning. Like, there's still hope in their lives at this point, even though they're getting slaughtered. But that's always the case, you know. But they're still at this point, they still believe that there's a chance they could be fighting for something good. And like, for me, I think that might be it. Like, I'm enjoying seeing the clones struggle and triumph over the droids again for the first time in quite a while.
So I'm reading the Legend book series Clone Commandos by Karen Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting some vibes. I was getting some vibes that Dave Filoni, I feel like 100% read some of those books and utilize like the camaraderie that the clones have as a way to, how do I say this, to like to pave the path for how we eventually come to know the clones in Clone Wars, right? Like the camaraderie that they have with each other, especially in episodes like Rookies and stuff, which we'll talk about later, but the camaraderie that they have with each other, there's like such a strong mirror image between the Clone Commandos books and the camaraderie that those squads have and the camaraderie that forms in Clone Wars, that like I feel almost like there's a direct reference there. And also, like, he's literally taken Scorch, which is one of the Clone Commandos, and used him in Bad Batch. Mm-hmm. And stuff too, right? So like there is that as well. But it's honestly really good, and you're 100% correct. Like, by the end of Clone Wars, the real tragedy is what has happened to the clones. Like, in the Siege of Mandalore arc, that final scene, right? All the helmets, you know, arranged outside of the crashed Venator. Like, it's heartbreaking, dude. The story of what happens to Fives, what happens to Jesse. Like, thank God Rex survives. I don't know if I could have taken it if he didn't, but it was like, it's exactly that. And this is kind of like going back to the beginning and being like, holy shit, this was the before times. Like, they'd only had a couple battles before this. Like, we barely know them. You know, obviously Rex is there, which is super cool, but it is really interesting to know where it all ends and then to go back to the beginning and watch something with that knowledge in your mind.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. It's true, I think.
Yeah.
Well, where are we at here in the movie? We've got...
Well, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't hit on like the key point, which is that Ahsoka gets dropped off.
Yeah.
Like you said, Anakin, Obi-Wan is like, oh, it's probably going to be my new Padawan. He says like, wink, wink, like could not be any more tongue in cheek.
Right.
And Ahsoka gets dropped off wearing, at the time, not something that I noticed, but now that we know, like, a somewhat inappropriate like crop top outfit for like a 13-year-old or whatever, especially one that's going into battle. You know, maybe Togruta culture is different for their young preteens and stuff. But at the time, I was like, huh. You know, actually, back in the day, I didn't even register in my mind. Now, slightly older, slightly wiser, I'm like, that was an interesting wardrobe choice. But, you know, it is what it is. So she gets out and she basically tells Anakin, oh, by the way, I'm your Padawan, actually. And Anakin is like, oh, no, absolutely not. There's got to be some mistake. I have no interest in teaching at all. And Ahsoka's like, okay, well, you can say whatever you want, but I'm definitely your Padawan. Yoda said so. So you can take it up with him later. But in the meantime, you're stuck with me.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely some entertaining friction between the two of them. And Obi-Wan's just like, oh, you know, we can settle this later. You know, I'm sure it's all just some mix up. really appreciate the voice acting there. It's just enough to where like you could take him at face value, but also like if you sort of know what's going on, then it feels very sort of wink wink. Like I'm sure it's a mix up, definitely. So yeah, it is really entertaining, and we immediately get some nicknames bandied about, or pretty close to immediately here, with Anakin or Ahsoka referring to him as Sky Guy. And then her snippy attitude very shortly earns her the nickname Snips, which lasts a little longer than Sky Guy does. Although my daughter still occasionally calls him Sky Guy.
Yeah, I wasn't the biggest fan of Sky Guy. I do like Snips for Ahsoka though. Snips is a good nickname for her.
It is.
It's they have some interesting back and forth, right? Like this movie came out and people hated Ahsoka. Like hated her character. Like Ashley Eckstein was beside herself. Like she literally had to put something out that was like, hey, you know, give it time. Like this is called character growth, right? Like if the character just comes right out and is perfect and awesome, then you lose a lot of the like emotional weight that you get from a character improving themselves, right? And like learning and growing. And that is something that Ahsoka 100% does over the course of the Clone Wars. Like seeing this version of her character, having just watched the Ahsoka movie, is like also exceptionally interesting to go back in time that far, right? But Ahsoka shows huge character growth throughout the Clone Wars series. She shows character growth throughout the Ahsoka series. And she's kind of like an annoying teenager. She's kind of like Anakin. You know, I think that's why Yoda chose Ahsoka specifically for Anakin, is that he is holding a mirror up to Anakin and being like, this is what you're like. Like, look at this person that's like a little you and use this to teach yourself, right? Like the actual fortune cookie that was supposed to be for this episode was to teach is to learn twice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Had this been a normal episode and not a movie. So I think that that's pretty... You know, that's pretty clever. What's also really funny is that so the in joke here is that Dave Filoni had planned for Ahsoka to be Obi-Wan's second Padawan. And George Lucas looked at her and was like, yeah, that's Anakin's Padawan. And Filoni was like, Anakin doesn't have a Padawan. And he said, Lucas looked at him and said, yes, he does. And like, that was the end of the discussion. Like, so they do a little misdirect in the beginning, the same way the misdirect was played on Filoni, where like he was like, oh, I'm going to create this character for Obi-Wan. And Luke's like, no, actually, I've decided Anakin has a Padawan now. And that's how it works. There's a lot of stuff in the history of the creation of this series that is like George Lucas just being like, you know, I think we should do this, with like little to no explanation. And then they just end up doing it. And it turns out really, really wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, sometimes it's just serendipity. Things just sort of work out the way that they're supposed to work out. And I think that's also, from everything that we've seen and learned, sometimes just how conversations with George Lucas go. You think it's going to go one way, but he's got a different picture in his head, and that's the picture that's going to happen. And honestly, thank goodness. Like, I can't say I agree with every decision that he has ever made in terms of making Star Wars stuff. I don't think the man is perfect, but he has really had a very clear vision about the big stuff, and having that clear central, like, guiding vision, I think, is really a big part of what has made the franchise so lasting.
You know, if I know you don't want to do this because you don't like documentaries, but I've been watching the Light and Magic documentary on Disney Plus again, which is the documentary specifically focused on ILM and its creation and what it did. And my God, man, it is truly incredible to see the way Lucas managed these teams. And I firmly believe that a large part of the reason why the Star Wars movies were so good, specifically why the originals were so good, even not even necessarily arguably, but I will say arguably much better than the prequels, despite the prequels also being incredible in their own way. The original trilogy, he didn't have time to micromanage. He literally was incapable of doing it. He had too much on his plate.
Yeah.
So a lot of what he did, and it showed this in the Light and Magic documentary, is he would basically come in and he'd be like, here's my vision. And he'd like put it on paper. They'd storyboard it out. And then he would give it to the people that were working on it. And the people who were working on it would do it the way, like, kind of the way they wanted, that matched, like, they would fulfill George's vision the way they felt like fulfilling it. And because George was too busy, he would only have time to come back in and being like that, don't like that, don't like that, right? He couldn't really come in and like nitpick every single little tiny detail. He only had time to like kind of swing in. And a number of people that they interviewed said that the way George managed was he gave them a clear idea of what it was that he wanted. And then he let the people do it their way for the most part. And they're like, that's not to say he wouldn't come back and say, oh, I don't like that, or oh, I'd like this to change. But for the most part, he'd be like, make me five creatures. They'd make him five creatures, and he'd be like, all right, I like those three. We're using those three. And then they would just use the creatures, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't like, oh, I think the nose should be like this, or the foot should be like this, or the hair should be a little different. And then he'd say, hey, I need a shot of a TIE fighter doing this. And they'd give it to him, be like, oh, well, why don't we rotate a little bit? All right, that's good. And it was because he was so busy. And then in the prequels, he was given like fully the ability to micromanage. And I remember watching the making of The Phantom Menace, which is called The Beginning, which is a documentary that we talked about, and literally thinking to myself, like, dude, what are you doing? Why are you counting how many buttons are on Padme Amidala's dress?
Yeah.
Like, that is a level of detail that is so far beneath what George Lucas should be doing. And I think that's kind of where the prequels got bogged down a little bit, is he kind of had too much freedom to micromanage. And because he micromanaged so hard, it feels like it didn't allow the people to necessarily do the absolute best jobs they could have. And what suffered for it was the actual story, right?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. As the famous quote goes, right? He may have gone too far.
Yeah. In a few places.
And, you know, I don't know if that's what happened with this film, to jump back to the actual topic at hand, but something happened. And anyways, we got what we got here. All right, so we've got Ahsoka and Anakin. We've got a problem, right? They're supposed to go and save Jabba the Hutt's son. We've sort of glossed over that whole subplot, which is the actual plot of the movie.
I know, what a shame. What a shame that that's the actual plot of the movie, and there's so much more interesting things to talk about that aren't that plot of the movie.
I have to say, so there is an audiobook version of this, and that plot, for my money, works a lot better in the audiobook version than it does in the feature film. And I think part of it is because you've got a lot less emphasis on the battles and like making things look cool, and you're just getting the actual story. And I think the actual story is pretty decent. And I think a lot of why this movie didn't really take off is something else. It's to do with the shots that they went with, or the animation, or some combination of factors. But I enjoyed the audiobook, and I would recommend anyone who was underwhelmed to give it a shot. And I think you may, at the very least, find yourself whelmed. There's a lot more like background information given. There's a lot more of like what's going on in Palpatine's head when this is happening. Like there's it's a different focus. I don't know.
So my thought is that like the story is fine, but the stakes are too low for me to feel the same draw that I do for the movies.
Yeah.
Right? Like
it's TV show stakes.
Yeah, like I never really cared about what was going on in this episode with Rada the Hutt and with Jabba the Hutt and with Zero the Hutt. Like all the Hutts, like, you know, Jabba survives, you know, Anakin survives, you know, it's very likely Ahsoka survives, Obi-Wan survives. It never really felt like, oh, okay, this is something like worthy of a movie. It just felt like a middle run of the mill story. And so I think what happened is, like, you know, this thing kind of got hyped up. It was like, this is a new Star Wars movie, right? Well, every Star Wars movie that had come out before this was like, was, you know, even the Phantom Menace had Duel of the Fates, right? Like there was some real stuff going on there. You know, Attack of the Clones had Geonosis. There was some real stuff going on there. The stakes were so, so low and so small in this. And it was like, oh no, a trade route through the Outer Rim.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like that was what they were kind of battling over. And, you know, I just, again, it didn't feel like a movie. It just didn't. It felt like an episode, or it felt like several episodes that were put together, which is exactly what it was. And so that's kind of why I think it plays badly as a movie. I think if you just watch this chronologically in the Clone Wars series, it's fine. Like, it, you know, it's somewhat forgettable, but it's fine. I have no issues with it. I think it slots in nicely with a bunch of the other like kind of middling episodes in the Clone Wars series that tell a fun story. That's an enjoyable story. It's a story to watch on the couch. It's not a story to watch in the theater. Right. It doesn't feel like I'm like going to grab a popcorn and a Coke and some whiskey, cause that's how I watch movies at the theater. Like, it doesn't feel like that type of story.
Yeah.
It feels like the story to watch while I'm like on my phone, kind of not really paying attention. And it's like playing in the background type of story.
It definitely, like, is the kind of story that, like, I've got playing on the TV with the speakers turned way up while I'm, like, making food and in and out of the kitchen and, like, trying to get chores done. And I'm not even necessarily looking at the screen the whole time.
Yeah, and if you miss something, you don't have to rewind it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and I think, to some extent, the stakes come across differently in the audio book version of it, where they feel a little higher because I think they're explained better. Here it's just hard to buy. And we have no real context going into the film, right? Like if we've seen a bunch of stuff before this where like they're fighting losing battles and, you know, they're struggling to to follow the Separatists because the Separatists have the Outer Rim to retreat to. You know, if there's some kind of setup, then maybe the stakes feel a little different. We don't really get that here, right? We're just sort of told, like, this is super important. We're going to lose the war if we don't get this. But there's no real, like, emotional build to it. We're not attached to that goal. And it's a very political goal, which is hard to sell in an action franchise. Like, Andor did a good job of selling political goals because it took what is normally an action franchise and turned it into a spy thriller, which is where you sell political goals as being high stakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not this. This is traditional action, science, fantasy, Star Wars, and the political overtones are lost. Which is unfortunate, you know, because it does sort of make the rest of the film fall a bit flat.
Yeah, they so to hit on those political goals, yeah, they basically, like, both the Separatist and the Republic are asking Jabba for safe passage through his trading routes in the Outer Rim. Apparently, Jabba the Hutt is nearly as powerful as the Republic, because he has the ability to, you know, control these trade routes, which I feel like the Republic, with their millions of clone troopers, could kind of just take if they wanted. But they probably feel like they don't really need to make an enemy if they don't have to make an enemy, right? Like, they'll just, you know, the enemy of your enemy is your friend at this point in time. So what is it that they do? He's been kidnapped. I feel like we learned pretty early on in this story that it's actually a Separatist plot.
Yeah.
So the Separatist have kidnapped Rata the Hutt, who is, according to some deep, deep lore, is 10 years old at this point. Now, I know he seems like a baby, but that's because apparently Hutts spend the first 50 years in the brood pouch of their parent maturing, but Jabba wanted his son to experience the world, and so that's why he was out of the pouch at such a young age. Don't ask me where that information comes from, but that is like the deep cut.
Yeah, Hutts, much like Yoda's species, live for hundreds of years, if not killed. And they're, you know, typically fairly difficult to kill simply because of their bulk. So, you know, they have a much slower maturation rate, much like, you know, Grogu, right, is like 50 years old, but is essentially a child because his species matures very slowly, because they live for almost 1,000 years.
When you were watching this, did you get to the part where they introduced Zero yet? Like Zero the Hutt? Have you seen him on TV yet?
No, I have not gotten quite that far yet. I think I'm pretty close.
I'm not gonna spoil that for you, because that is certainly something. what is it that happens? So Anakin and Ahsoka go off to the planet of Teth.
Mm-hmm.
While Obi-Wan flies over to Tatooine to basically assure Jabba that that the Jedi will find Rata and will bring him back. They find a monastery on Teth where they believe that Rata is, and they storm the monastery, basically, with like a long drawn out sequence with them climbing the vertical cliff face.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know that those little walkers, ATTEs or whatever, could climb vertically, but apparently they can.
Yeah.
There's some brutal scenes of some of the walkers getting peeled off the cliff face backwards, and, you know, people getting shot, and it's actually quite violent.
A bit of fun trivia for all the parents out there: Battle at Teth is actually a children's book made just from this part of the story.
Doesn't seem like a very fun part of the story to make a children's book from.
Well, so it's the whole temple scene, essentially, except with everything that happens with Anakin cut out. It's just the clone troopers part of the story.
Oh.
So they storm the temple, they seize the temple, you know, they get the Separatists, then, you know, come back, and Asajj Ventress leads them in, and the troopers get captured. Most of them get killed. You know, they're sort of having their last stand in the courtyard when, you know, Anakin finally shows up to give them some relief. Like, that is a children's story, apparently, written literally for like first grade reading level. I know this because I've read it to my daughter so many times.
Is there any good trivia from that book that that improves this scene in the movie?
No.
Ah, shame.
I'm pretty sure all of the pictures in the book are just like actual like screen caps from the the movie.
That's the cheapest way to make a children's book ever. That's brilliant.
I mean, it's I don't know if there are other ones in the series that tell the rest of the story, but yeah, they're clever. They're very clever. I didn't even realize it was part of the movie because I hadn't seen it. I thought that was the whole story. I was just like, I don't know why they're rescuing this hut. Seems like not a good thing to do.
So I'm going to assume that the part you got to in this and the part where we're going to stop in this story. So Anakin and Ahsoka managed to make it up to the top. Surprise, surprise, it turns out it's a trap, right? And the plan that they kind of have
shocker
is Dooku is going to has videotaped them using Asajj Ventress, which is his apprentice. Asajj has videotaped them holding the hut so that they can send the footage to Jabba and say, see, it was actually the Jedi who kidnapped your son. They're lying to you, which, you know, Jabba falls for it, you know, head over tail.
Which I have to say is possibly the lamest Star Wars trap I've ever heard of.
It was like somewhat unnecessarily devious. And at the same time, it was like really anticlimactic. But I was like, you know, whatever. Hey, they got Christopher Lee in here. Hilariously enough. And like, this is some behind the scenes. I have a lot of behind the scenes trivia on voices for this movie, by the way. They had already recorded all of the all of the audio with Corey Burton as Dooku. And then when they decided to make it a movie, they were like, oh, why don't we ask Christopher Lee if he'll come back in? So this is actually his last time playing the character, but he came back in and did the voice for the character. And they actually got Samuel L. Jackson the same way to do the voice for Mace Windu. Now, interestingly, for Matt Lanter, he was auditioning for a character called Deke Starkiller. And he was told to play the character like a cross between Luke Skywalker and Han Solo. And he didn't know he was going to be Anakin until he had already actually gotten the part. Right. And then similarly, Ashley Eckstein was auditioning for Padme, which is a much smaller role, still a decent role in the Clone Wars. She was auditioning for Padme and they basically told her, no, you sound too young. But then they called her back and they had her mess around with a couple of different accents. And then they eventually said, you know what? Why don't you just do your normal voice? Just do your normal voice. That's perfect for Ahsoka. And Ahsoka was actually called Ashla at the beginning. Ashla is the name of a Togruta Padawan that is briefly seen in the background of episode 2, Attack of the Clones. But then partway through, George Lucas was like, actually, I don't really want to make this connection. Let's make it a completely different character. And that's where Ahsoka came from. So like this, somehow, I don't know how, there is an unlimited amount of trivia about this particular movie.
And Ashla is actually the fake name that she gives in the Ahsoka novel as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's a name that originally came from George Lucas's super early draft when it was called the Journal of the Wills. Ashla was a name of like the female manifestation of the Force, which then later on becomes the sister, which then later on becomes Ahsoka anyways, right? So like it all circles back. It's like symmetry, you know, it rhymes. And if you want to hear a sad bit of trivia from this, which is still a very good bit of trivia, there is a scene when they are all in a hangar and there's a little R2 droid that is like a pink R2 droid. And that droid has an official name. It is R2KT. And what it is for a member of the 501st Legion, which is like the cosplayers who dress up in Star Wars costumes, but like super elaborate movie accurate costumes. A member of the 501st Legion, his daughter unfortunately was diagnosed with cancer at a very young age and she passed away. And before she passed away, the artist at Lucasfilm actually made her a little pink R2 droid and gave it to her as like a gift to like watch over her. And so that little pink R2 droid is actually that droid that they made for her. And that's why it has the official name of R2KT. So also some deep cut trivia there.
Man, truly, truly an unlimited amount of like super random deep cuts in this film.
I don't know if it was because it was a movie and so like people talked about it more or they did like more press tours or more was written about it. But the fact that the synopsis is like seven paragraphs long, when a normal episode synopsis of just one episode is as long as that, but the trivia is like 90 things long instead of, you know, 10, which is what we get in a normal episode. So a weird flipping of the script there for us.
Yeah. Well, I think that more or less brings us to pretty close to a stopping point.
Oh, but I have more trivia. Tonight,
oh,
I have.
Oh,
so,
you have more trivia.
So. Okay. Okay. So
I withdraw my statement.
So Dooku tells Asajj Ventress, you either have to get the Hutlet back from the Jedi, or you need to kill the Hutlet so we can blame it on the Jedi, right? One of the two. Anakin and Ahsoka manage to escape, and they hijack a derelict transport. This transport is called the Twilight, right? And he actually keeps this transport. He uses it many times in the future throughout the Clone Wars series. Like, he keeps this, he repairs it. It's his transport that he uses. Filoni said that he did this so that the original line where Uncle Owen tells Luke, like, your uncle or your father was a navigator on a spice freighter or something like that, and the original, you know, the original trilogy, is now technically accurate, because the Twilight was a derelict spice freighter. And so he's like, you know, that's another little deep cut right there. But I did like the Twilight. Anyways, they fly away. They manage to escape. Ahsoka uses a med hologram droid on the, you know, on the Twilight to treat the sick Hutlet, which I thought was going to be like a bigger deal. And then it was like, oh no, actually you just give him these pills. And then he's like, totally fine. It doesn't really do anything. Cause like right before that, they're like, he's going to die. And they're just like, no, just give him like two aspirin and little dude will be fine. But Obi-Wan arrives to kind of like head Ventress off at the end. And this is where we consistently get that there's like a raw chemistry. I hesitate to call it sexual, but I will call it sexual, between Asajj and Obi-Wan. And I think that it plays out throughout the entire Clone Wars, where every time they're fighting, it sounds almost like they're flirting with each other. Every single time.
A little bit. It truly does. It truly does come off that way. I think there is a bit of tension there, you know? But it's unexplored, so we'll never know.
His heart belongs to Satine and no one else.
And Asajj, as it turns out, finds her match in Quinlan. So I guess it was just never meant to be.
That is true. Also an exceptional story.
Yeah. There's one that I don't even know if you could make it into a movie. I feel like it'd be too long.
That would have been a fantastic movie if it was anywhere as close to as good as it was as a book. I mean, but yeah, that's an 8-episode arc right there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, no, that by modern standards, I mean, what is that? That'd be 2 hours and 40 minutes.
That's true. Yeah, that's a pretty standard movie length these days.
That'd be a tough one to do, right? Because the characters that we're used to in Star Wars are side characters in that. Like, that is fully focused on Asajj and Keenan Voss.
Yeah. And it's phenomenal.
That would be like Rogue One levels of like characters that you basically don't know at all. Which, hey, Rogue One is one of my favorite movies. So,
you know, it's a new age. It's a new age for Star Wars. And I think many things are possible that weren't before. You know, I have a feeling we're going to see more and more original characters, or new characters at the very least, coming to the forefront, and frankly I'm here for it. So
yeah. All right, well, I mean, I guess we'd be remiss not to grade the first half. Mm-hmm. I feel a bit sad about this because I want to grade the first quarter like pretty highly, like an 8, maybe an 8.5. I really enjoyed the entire Christophsis episode. First 20 minutes, really liked it.
Yeah.
Had a blast. Enjoyed meeting a new character for the, you know, again. thought it was fun. After that, it's not bad. It's like you said, it's not bad.
Yeah.
It's kind of middling.
It just feels like it should be TV, and it feels weird that it's a movie. And I think that sort of disconnect really almost makes it feel worse than it is. But anyways, I'm going to throw a 7 out there for the first half.
I'm going to throw a 7 as well, because I give Christophsis an 8, and then I give the first half of the hut thing, of the castle arc, a 6. So a 7 seems fair.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a shame, because it's like, for the first Star Wars movie in years to go into theaters, you would have hoped that they would have put something better together than a 7. And I really think what happened is George wasn't really paying attention to the story. He was paying attention to like the technology, mm-hmm. and like the appearance of what was being done. And he was so kind of enraptured by that, that he was like, well, just throw something together and put it in the theaters. But jokes on everybody, it was an $8 million budget and it made like $65 million. So that probably paid for the entire rest of the first two seasons.
Pretty much, yeah. It turns out it didn't need to be a critical success in any regard.
Mm-hmm.
It was virtually guaranteed to make money hand over fist, and that's what happened. Not too many films, I think, turn into 8 bangers there right out of the gate. So especially not films made for $8 million.
Now, the better question is, your daughter, is she watching this with you?
She is.
Or did she? She is. So how has she felt about the first half so far?
She was actually very upset that I made her go to bed. Mm. And honestly, that's part of the reason I'm only halfway through. If we're being completely brutally honest about my life right now, dragging out trying to get that kid into bed on a school night really filled the rest of my time to sit and actually watch the film. So, but hey, you know, I guess it worked out for her, because now she gets to watch the rest of it with me, which I feel like may have been the ultimate goal here. I feel like I may have been manipulated.
Feels like it was worth it.
Yeah. You know, it'll all work out in the end.
All right. So that is it for this episode, episode 89. We will be back on Sunday, or Monday for you guys. We'll record on Sunday. You'll hear it on Monday with episode 90. And we're going to be talking about the conclusion. And I don't know. I don't know how much. I feel like we covered a lot of the trivia for this. I might try to find some more. We'll talk about the conclusion, the last two parts. Who knows? Maybe we'll hit a single episode of Clone Wars 2, or maybe we'll save that for next week. But I'm really excited to do Clone Wars in chronological order. I think that is going to be super, super interesting. It's going to be weird, because like some of the time it's like just a single one-off episode.
Yeah.
And then some of the times it's like 4 episodes in a row with like this super intense, like deep, you know, deep push into stuff. So.
Well, I feel like it's going to bring things to light in a different, in a very different way than watching the episodes in release order did. So I've not actually watched it chronologically before. I wish that they would like make a chronological playlist so that I didn't have to do it manually.
I know. It's weird, isn't it? Like, they have on StarWars.com, there is a chronological list of Clone Wars episodes. It's like, why is this not an option?
Yeah.
On Disney Plus, where I could just watch them, because I'm telling you, it is much better if you can get over the like weird jumping of the animations.
Yeah,
because like that's the thing that's hard, is that like it goes season 2 season 1 season 1 season 3 season 3 season 1, right? And like, because it does that, especially at the beginning, towards the tail end it's like all just in chronological order.
Yeah,
but at the beginning it's kind of all over the place. And so if you can get over the like jumping and how the animation changes in the first couple seasons, it's really, really, really good to watch it chronological, like much better than it is to watch it in release order.
Yeah, and that's I know you've said it a number of times. And that's kind of why I'm excited about going back to our roots as a show, and going back to kind of some of what got us started on this whole path, and rewatching it that way, because I've never done that. I've never sat and watched it that way. So I think it's going to be a really interesting ride.
It also, it makes the clone story pretty cool, because you get those two clone focused episodes in season three.
Right.
You get those super early on. And also there's that one random, that Cat and Mouse episode from season two, like the middle of season two, which is the earliest episode in the series. And it's also a single standalone episode. And it's just like buried in the middle of season two. I remember when I watched it through the first time, I was like, what episode is that? I was like, how does that make sense? Like, what's going on here? Turns out it's the first episode chronologically. It's just a standalone episode buried in season two that has no explanation for why it's there.
Yeah.
And happens in between two other arcs. So it literally doesn't make any sense at all. So yeah, the chronological is the way to go. We've talked about, you know, the Beneath Twin Suns order for how you should watch Star Wars stuff, which now at this point in time has gotten, it's very weighty, right? Yeah. Like there's a lot to watch. If you want to watch Star Wars, oh my God, like there's an endless amount that you could watch at this point. I feel like even when we started this, there wasn't really that much that you could watch, right? And now it feels like there's significantly more.
There's a lot. It does feel like there's a lot more now. And I think figuring out the order that things go in and the occasional interruptions that things have is a little bit more nuanced than it ever had to be before. Ultimately, like truly, if you want to watch Star Wars, just watch Star Wars, the movie first, start there, and then we'll talk.
Mm-hmm. You should always start with the original trilogy. I will stand by that. I think that is the core part of the Beneath Twin Suns order that makes the most thing, is like, you got to start with the original trilogy.
Yeah.
And then you go back to the prequels, then you watch the original trilogy again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it's done. That's how you get the full effect, as opposed to, you know, doing it chronologically for the movies, doing it chronologically. I feel like you miss out on too much.
Yeah. It's not good. It ruins, truly. Truly, I think watching the prequels, if you've never seen the original trilogy, in no small way ruins your experience of the original trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just full stop. And I enjoy, I'm a prequel enjoyer. I wouldn't call myself a full-on apologist or an absolute prequel lover, but I am certainly a prequel enjoyer. And like, I think one time somebody told me that they watched those first, and I was like, I was upset. Like, I wasn't mad at them, but I was just like, so sad for them.
Yeah, just like, damn, that's a shame.
Like, oh man, no.
You missed out.
Oh, don't finish it. Stop. Watch the original trilogy. Oh yeah, gosh.
And some people swear by like the machete order, which like uses the Phantom Menace as like some weird flashback type stuff. And I'm like, you know, y'all are basically headcanoning like shit, which is fine. I appreciate it, right? Like I was talking to, I forget who it was. I think I was talking to one of my buddies, or I might've been talking to someone in Discord, but I was saying like, I appreciate when people use their imagination to improve the story, right? Like too many people nowadays, we talked about this, I think at the tail end of Ahsoka, like they poke a bunch of holes in fiction, right? There's always going to be holes in fiction because it's fiction. It's not real. It didn't actually happen. I respect so much more when people use their imagination to improve upon the story, right? And it's like, yeah, you know what? There is a hole. Well, here's my headcanon for why that hole doesn't matter. Like that's what I like. That's what I respect. And so I respect the like machete type thing. But at the same time, I feel like you gotta see the filmmaker's vision as it was intended. You know?
Yeah. 100%.
It's fine if you want to go back and watch it in machete order or something, then do it. But like for the very first time, I feel like it's super important to, you know, see it as the filmmaker kind of intended you to see it. Because the filmmaker's trying to tell a story, right? And after you've seen that story, if you think that there's some ways that it could be improved, which we all do, we all have this stuff. I mean, how many times have we sat here and talked about how what we would have cut out of the sequels, right?
Yeah.
Or what we would have added to the sequels. We all do that. But at the same time, like, watch the filmmaker's vision first, get what they're trying to say, and then take your machete to it or whatever it is that you want to do.
Exactly. Exactly.
Although not that anybody's listening to the show who hasn't seen Star Wars before. So I feel like we might be preaching to the jizz whalers, right? I don't know if that works. I was going to say preaching to the choir, but in Star Wars, the Max Rebo's band is like the jizz whalers. So, you know, it kind of works, right?
I on that note, I'm going to say good night, sir.
All right. Later, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Until then, may the force be with you.
And also with you.